Thank you for tuning into the VF1 show with VF and Vincenzo, the podcast that discusses all things business, marketing, politics, and government within the world of Formula One. If that's your thing, then you found the right place. So without further ado, it's lights out and away we go.
Welcome back to the VF1 show. My name is Vincenzo Landino. Joining me on the podcast, as always, is VF Castro. We'll hear from her in a second. But today we are talking about Saudi Arabia. We're going to talk a little bit about what happened in 2022, oil and its grip on F1, implications of the wind tunnel reduction, how is time awarded in F1, and what does that mean for Red Bull? Some random stuff. Kim Kardashian with a racing license, Haas being accused of violating sanctions against Russia, and F1 viewership drop. All that coming up on the show. But let me say hello to the ever luminous VF Castro. How are you doing today, V?
I'm good. I heard we're under a tornado watch today, so that's fun, but we'll get there when we get there. How are you?
Fantastic. We are not under a tornado watch, but we are cold. I don't know. It's like 20 something degrees outside. That's Fahrenheit for those that are in different countries. So it's cold. It is what it is. I mean, here we are in the middle of March. I guess it should be this way up north.
That's just rude.
Yeah, it is what it is. We deal. We continue.
We persevere. We will rebuild.
Feel like watching like The Last of Us or The Walking Dead. We will persevere. We will rebuild.
I mean, listen. Annie. Weather can be oppressive. I'm just saying.
It can be. I'm not one of those that lets weather bother me. I don't know what this is, but maybe this is like an immigrant thing or maybe just everybody of this generation, like my parents. It's always about, the conversation's always about the weather. It always starts with the weather. How's the weather today? The weather's great. What do I care about the weather though? Like, it is what it is. Well, you know, if it's snowing, be careful. Be careful, okay? And then there's like a 5-minute conversation about like different weather related things, and to me, it's just not of interest.
You know why I think that is? I think it's because the weather dictates our mood so much that we wake up and it's like if it's bright and sunny outside, we're instantly happier than if it's we wake up and it's just dark and dreary. So, and anyone who lives in places where there's like prolonged rain knows this, but. Yeah, I think that that's why weather is such a conversation starter, is because it's such a mood dictator.
I feel you. It can be. I think, and I don't want to go too deep into this, but like I think there's definitely, at least again, that generation, you know, what's the first thing they do? They turn on the news in the morning, the news at night, and it's, they tell you kind of like, oh, this is what it's going to be like tomorrow, or this is what it's like outside. And they kind of already add their little bit of like, oh, it's a bummer, it's snowing, or oh, it's a bummer, it's raining. And you're kind of like, oh, man, it's raining, or oh, it's going to snow again. But I don't know. I don't think you have to look at it that way, right? I mean, if you just go based on whatever is happening outside, you just, your mood isn't already dictated. So that's my little preachy point of the day.
Except if there's a tornado.
I mean, yes. Okay. That's a little bit different, but. Just like, oh, it's raining, or oh, it's snowing, or oh, it's sunny, or partly cloudy, or whatever. I'll take it or leave it. Yeah, I roll with it. All right. I want to jump into this because this is something you've been chomping at the bit to talk about for sure. And it's definitely relevant. We are going to the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix this weekend. The second time it's on the calendar. Last year was the first. Last year there was a scenario where during some of the practice sessions, there was a bombing or an attack on an Aramco facility very nearby, within 10 kilometers, I believe, of the track. And the drivers visibly were able to pick up smoke and whatnot from this, from this attack. Or from the bombing itself, there was a whole meeting about whether they should continue, and they chose to continue. And then some things came out later on about the government of Saudi Arabia actually making ultimatums that they wouldn't allow drivers to leave the country. And I don't even know if all of this was 100% confirmed, but they said that, you know, if they didn't put the Grand Prix on, they would make it very difficult for some of these F1 folks to leave the country. Anyway, so that happened last year. The question you posed, which I'm going to kick it out to you, is what kind of grip does oil have on Formula One? These are cars. These are internal combustion engines that require petrol to run. So to some extent, to the very least extent, from the highest of high levels, that's the minimum, right? You're like, okay, it's a racing series with gasoline and oil. So that kind of is tied in. But at a deeper level, and you're going to go into this, what grip does it really have on the world of Formula One?
Right. I mean, this is a super interesting and complex issue. I just want to give listeners a background on the entire conflict. So it began in the Arab Spring of 2011, where protests in Middle Eastern and North African countries broke out over citizens wanting their countries or their governments to be more democratic. A fruit vendor set himself on fire because he was told he could no longer sell his goods. And so that's kind of what started all of this. And so there was a coalition between the UK, Italy, France, Canada, and the US, which were acting under the UN Security Council authority. They launched an operation that was intended to protect the citizens from then Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, who actually took power of Libya in 1969 via a military coup. So fast forward to the Libyan government, they were accusing NATO of attempting to assassinate Gaddafi. So several conflicts happened, multiple human rights violations. There were protests in Bahrain that broke out called the Day of Rage, culminated into Bloody Tuesday due to the violence the protesters experienced. And it's important to kind of note that before this, the UK supplied $50 million USD in arms to Bahrain during the Arab Spring. And reports have also alleged that it's inevitable that violations of international humanitarian and human rights, really laws by the coalition, may have been involved by the arms supplied by the UK. So this is where F1 gets involved. So last March, as you said, just 2 days before the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, Houthi rebels hid in an Aramco oil facility just 6 miles away from the track. The Yemeni Houthis are backed by Iran, which is not a member of, there's an unofficial Israeli-Arab coalition right now, and those countries are made up of Israel, Morocco, Egypt, Jordan, Bahrain, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia. Their focus is on regional security, not necessarily oil. But there were 6 Formula One teams, which are based in the UK, present at the race, including Aston Martin. Okay, so remember that Aramco isn't just a Formula One sponsor, it's also an Aston Martin title sponsor. What we also know is that roughly 28.2 million barrels of oil is produced in the Middle East every single day. And this is important because we know that oil is a significant player in global international security, and there's direct involvement between F1 countries and countries at war. And this is, the wars are largely over economics, and Yemen is essentially involved in a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. The Houthis are allies with Russia. We know Russia is experiencing its own issues right now with its war in Ukraine. So I don't necessarily know that that's an issue, but even the U.S. has accused Saudi Arabia of helping fund Russia's war against Ukraine through OPEC supply cuts, which benefited Russia's oil output. So remember, all this is really entangled in oil. So because the theme is oil and race viewership is at 70.3, it was at 70.3 million in 2021, it is a marketing goldmine for these oil companies. Likewise, it also makes Formula One a very large target. So according to the Campaign Against Arms Trade, the Saudi attacks on Yemen had death tolls in the thousands, and when drivers protested against Saudi Arabia and the controversies, this is partially what they're referring to. So a ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia was established shortly after the attack last year, We know that Saudi Arabia is committed to Formula One. It's even relaxed many of its laws, including compulsory hijab for women. And as far as oil's involvement in all this and the death grip that it has on Formula One, I mean, this is it. As long as oil and gas companies are title sponsors, the potential is always going to be there for warring countries to use races to send a message. And knowing that, I mean, Formula One continues to grow. So it makes a great audience really for their attacks to be conveyed. So there was a recent development in all of this that kind of shocked a lot of people. China brokered a deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which raised eyebrows and concerns between global alliances, because America is usually involved in these peace deals, as everybody knows, but China has been threatening as a global power for a very long time now. And so this is a huge development in the diplomatic order. And according to the New York Times, the Saudis have said this agreement was to establish long-term stabilized relations with Iran to curtail Iran-backed military groups, aka the Houthis, from attacking the Saudi kingdom. So according to the people I know, the American leaders are skeptical that Iran is going to even stick to the agreements. We'll see. But again, as we just talked about, or as you said in the intro, that there's this oil death grip on F1. This is why these attacks were so important last year from a global and IR relations perspective. And this is why I think Formula One fans, they continue to have these narratives that sports and F1, or sports and politics, don't belong in the same sentence. Yes, they do. Unfortunately, with Formula One, this is a completely different beast. Once you get oil involved in anything, you are inviting all the conflicts, all the wars from all these other countries that really rely on oil, especially for these countries that are heavily oppressed because of the politics, especially going on in the Middle East. So that's kind of the wrap up, the recap of that and why that is so important. So yeah, I think when anybody says, don't put politics in my sports, I think this is a great argument to shut that down immediately.
Yeah, they seem to go hand in hand, right?
It's
you can't talk about one without talking about the other. And F1 has been dominated by, you know, different massive oil companies, you know, participating in the sport. So it's not like it's something new to this generation of the sport. It's just always been there. And throughout the history, or at least recent history, modern history, I don't even know what modern history entails, but in more recent history, or at least the history throughout the history of F1, you know, there's been plenty of oil crisis, gas crises, wars because of oil and all that kind of stuff. The wars continue because of oil. It's like it's so tied in many different ways. The conversation that, you know, F1's not political is kind of, like you said, it's just kind of, it's laughable at best. And speaking of, hinted at something that Christian Horner said, where he said, you know, F1's not political. And I figured I can segue right into another Red Bull topic of conversation and something maybe a little bit lighter, but also interesting for those that don't know it. When Red Bull was given their sanction or penalty for going over the cost cap last year, one of the implications was a wind tunnel reduction. Now, the wind tunnel reduction, or the wind tunnel testing, is already based on your position in the standings, or your finished position for the previous year. So Red Bull already had the lowest amount anyway, because of obviously they won the championship. And then it just goes up by at that point. So the last place team gets the most wind tunnel time, and whatever, you can do the math that way. What has been talked about in the past couple days, or at least discussed, I think Helmut Marko said something like, well, our advantage will start to fall away as we lose wind tunnel time. And so I guess the question or the thought here is, how is time awarded in F1? And what could it actually mean for Red Bull? So I put that question out to
I guess the both of us really, in terms of allocation. Do you know how time is allocated?
Time is allocated. I know it's a handicap system. The team that finishes last, I believe, gets 115% of the time allowance. And I think there's 70% for the previous year's constructors champion. So I know it's a 5% increase as you go down the constructors. So I think because of its 10% reduction in the wind tunnel, I think I read somewhere that Red Bull is going to have 202 runs in the wind tunnel this season, compared to Ferrari, which has 240 runs. So when you think of a run in the wind tunnel, it's an experiment, and you get data from, you're able to extract a ton of data from that. And so the less, you know, I think the more, and Charles Leclerc's already going to have a grid penalty because of, did he change his PU?
Who?
Charles Leclerc.
No, he changed his control electronics again.
Okay. So he already has a grid penalty from that. And so they're already working on the car. So, I mean, this is getting onto a fast start from a lot of these teams in terms of their car development. And I do think that could affect Red Bull down the line. But I think that is going to come from Aston Martin, mainly, if it continues, because they have more time than both Red Bull and Mercedes. So I think in terms of development, Red Bull might have Aston Martin to deal with in the future.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people should understand is that, because the question, and I see a lot of this on Twitter, people are like, oh, well, look at that. The penalty didn't affect them. You know, what kind of penalty is it if it doesn't affect them? First of all, the penalty affects them in essentially the following year, right? So while it seems like a little bit backwards, the penalty wasn't levied until, you know, almost the middle or end of last year, right? For a violation the previous year, because that's just the way, you know, that's the time it takes to figure things out. I'm going to accept that. I'm not going to go into conspiracies and Red Bull mafia and all this crap that people want to talk about. It is what it is. It takes time to go through this, levy a penalty, listen to appeals, all that. So they're going to feel it towards the latter half of this year, or just depending on how they decide to allocate their wind tunnel time. So this is the other thing, right? There's different wind tunnel testing periods throughout the year that each team has to use up certain amounts of time. I believe it's broken into six, and then you're allowed different wind tunnel allowances within that. But you can use it however you want within that period. So Red Bull could choose to use it all up early in the year, try to rack up a huge advantage, and then as their time, you know, gets cut, maybe towards the end of the year, they're hoping they have a big enough lead to where it may not matter as much. But it is interesting to hear people say, oh, well, you know, this doesn't hurt them. The penalty didn't hurt them. And you mentioned it, and I'll just kind of reiterate it. Red Bull's effective wind tunnel time over the next 10 months over the next 10 months starting from, I think it was last November, right? So it's like 63%. Meanwhile, you have the teams at the bottom that are, you know, at 110, 115%. So, you know, that is an equalizer of sorts. It should be. Of course, there's other things to factor in, but Red Bull just has to really manage it right now. So managing that is going to be, you know, something very important. I think they have an advantage to begin with, so it may seem to hurt them less, but it's not because the cost cap didn't work, or it's not because the cost cap penalty didn't work. It takes time for that to end up kicking in, and it's also going to affect a team like Red Bull, who has somebody like an Adrian Newey and has the money to have, you know, a massive team it's going to affect them less anyway, right? As it probably would affect a Ferrari or a Mercedes less to hit them. Imagine if those a penalty like that got levied against one of the bottom teams, that would hurt them significantly more. They already can't do enough with the wind tunnel time they're given. Imagine taking away more from them. So, I think you have to kind of take your expectations down for those that are like, oh, Red Bull should have been creamed. No, that's not realistic. But later in the year, we'll see if they continue with their, their aero supremacy or their just supremacy in general. I think it will affect them later in the season, probably after the break, the summer break, if it's going to affect them at all. But if they've got a massive lead at that point, it won't matter. Couple random things popped up yesterday. Let's go into, well, this one's just funny. Kim Kardashian, she posted a picture of her racing license for the Malibu Grand Prix. And did you see that?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you remember Malibu Grand Prix?
I don't remember the Malibu Grand Prix.
My wife grew up in Columbus, Ohio. And so I've been coming to Columbus, Ohio for the past almost decade now. There was a Malibu Grand Prix here in Columbus. There's a bunch of locations, mostly through the South, Midwest regions. I believe there were some international locations as well of Malibu Grand Prix. But the one here in Columbus, Ohio, I know that there's a lot of people that kind of still talk about it. The old building that it was in is like a school now or something like that. But there's still portions of the track that you can kind of see in the playground of the school, which is really, it's one of those nostalgic things. And the biggest one actually wasn't even in California. The biggest Malibu Grand Prix location was in Miami, funny enough. Which is now like apartment buildings. So it was just one of those nostalgic things. I don't know why she posted it. I don't know what, made her want to do that. But there have been some other really cool license holders, including Paul Newman, who was Paul Newman. I mean, like, dude could go race real cars. And he loved Malibu Grand Prix. Leonardo DiCaprio and Tupac all had licenses. And I'm sure there's plenty of other celebrities, but those were the ones that I found in quickly just looking it up. As soon as she posted, I was like, oh my God, Malibu Grand Prix. That's so funny. And so, just a little race back to the past. I love nostalgia. And so like 90s and 80s racing culture is just so cool. I mean, these things were basically mini Indy F1 cars, but they were basically just go-karts, right? And people would go and race them, and they would go as long as, as much as they can. It would cost like $1 to go racing. I mean, oh, that would be awesome to go karting right now for $1 and as many laps as you want. But alas, inflation and other things. Speaking of inflation and other things, I guess this is not really inflation, but Haas, did you see the Haas story that they got accused of violating sanctions against Russia?
Yeah.
I'm going to let you take that one because this is your jam. What happened?
Okay. So Haas was accused of violating sanctions against Russia. Essentially, they were accused from a PBS article of selling parts to Russia. It's essentially what the accusation was, to summarize it in this PBS interview. Haas released a statement. Haas CNC released a statement yesterday. That said, it is a bitter irony, therefore, that the PBS report paints Haas as being supportive of the Russian military, which couldn't be further from the truth. At a time when Americans are struggling to develop the most effective course of conduct in support of Ukraine, it is irresponsible in the extreme for PBS to present this poorly sourced hit piece, which ignores basic facts and asserts other facts that are clearly false. So Haas released sort of a bullet point statement also that has the material facts, if you will. It said that Haas has always been in full compliance with U.S. government export control. No machines have shipped from the Haas factory to Russia since March 3rd, 2022. The 18 machines referenced in the story left the Haas factory prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Haas voluntarily chose to terminate its relationship with the Russian distributor, which has never been required by any U.S. sanctions. And Haas completely supports Ukraine and its people in their defense against Russia. So, yeah, Haas is adamantly denying the report. And I don't really know where else to go with this other than what they're telling us is now a direct contradiction of what this PBS report says. And, you know, I think that if Russia or if Haas was found to have been in violation of sanctions, I wonder what the implications would be with Formula One, because we talked about this previously on this podcast, that what happened with Ural Kali also, I think, kind of put a target on other drivers, on them potentially being restricted from races for however long this decision by the FIA was to ban Russian drivers. And so we know that whatever course of action would come from this would be swift and it would be strict. So you have to wonder what the FIA would do if it was found that Haas did violate sanctions. And I mean, you really have to wonder what, you have to kind of be concerned that that would be a very strong penalty, if not almost forcing Haas out of the sport entirely. I don't know how they would be able to do that, but I hope for Haas's sake that what they're saying is 100% accurate and that they can prove their innocence in this, because this is a pretty strong accusation.
Yeah, and just for clarification purposes, Haas Automation is the company that's being accused. It's not like the Haas F1 team. Obviously, Haas Automation is the sponsor of the Haas team. Gene Haas owns Haas Automation. And also for clarity and transparency of the report, it was reported by PBS, but it was a Ukrainian watchdog report that was filed with U.S. regulators that PBS reported on. So take that what you wish. I'm not going to imply anything there other than the facts. Haas Automation, they are known for very, very precise machinery. There's very specific and tools that they make, including parts that are the machines and the parts that they can produce. They require, you know, robotic computer controlled manufacturing process, and Russia doesn't have that ability. So that's why there's this this talk about it, right? Where it's like, well, Russia doesn't have that capability, and Haas is the only company or one of the few companies that can actually produce things that are, you know, made for guided missiles and complex vehicles and airframes and munitions. And they already have a tie with a Russian oligarch who has ties to Putin. So there's like all of that going on there, right? It's like, let's start just connecting dots. That's basically what they're doing. I too hope that Haas is not actually involved with this. That would be terrible, just from an optics perspective, but also just from a, you know, humanity perspective. Like, you know, don't be getting involved in something after you went through the motions of getting rid of Ural Kali last year, right? Like, you can't. Which is why it almost to me like makes no sense. It's like, why would you go and do that, which you had to, right? You really needed to, and then at the same time you're going behind or trying to fly under the radar, haha, no pun intended. And you know, shipping this machinery or these components to Russia, like that would just be terrible. And I don't know if that's something you would be able to come back from if it's accurate, right? Like this almost feels like, and I don't want to turn this into this, but it almost feels like an opportunity for Andretti, right?
Yeah.
So this report has to be false, because if it's not, it's going to open the door for a lot of other things.
This is why, though, I said what I said about this could be, if this is accurate, then this could be fatal, because we know what happened with F1 and Ural Kali. We know what happened with Nikita Mazepin. We know how serious the FIA is about this. And for Haas's sake, I hope this is completely inaccurate and that they're able to prove their innocence, because like I said, this is a very, very serious allegation, all things considered. And I don't know. I think there are lots of piranhas in the water right now wanting to get into Formula One, and they're waiting for an opportunity. And I think right now, if you're one of those teams kind of waiting to get in, you're looking at this saying, please be accurate. But I think for all of us in F1, we're like, no, please don't be accurate. This is really bad for the sport. This is horrible for the sport.
Yeah, it's definitely not something that would bode well, at least in the news cycle, a couple news cycles where it's like, wow, you're going to make, you know, a team that's ready to come in and that has the money that you've said that, you know, we need to have, but you'll allow these types of folks in the sport. And so that kind of PR mudslinging will start to happen. And that's not good when you start to cannibalize from the inside either. I think F1 needs to definitely pay attention to the situation. I'm sure they are. I'm sure their lawyers and PR folks are all over this, as is the Haas automation folks. But I'm curious to see what else comes out of this. Is this kind of the first of many articles or you know, reports that are filed, or will we continue to get that the longer the war in Ukraine and Russia goes on, right? Because the longer that goes on, the more pressure there's going to be on potential supporters of it. And if that's the way people are looking, or Ukraine is looking at Haas, there's going to be more noise. So is this the first to see if it kind of backs them away, or is it, you know, is it going to continue? That leads us to F1 viewership, right? This is all tied in. Let's just go there. This is all tied in because people care about what's happening. At least they say they do. And viewership for last race in Bahrain actually dropped. Now, you know me, I don't think it means anything. I think it's a no big deal sort of thing. I'm going to throw the numbers out there at you. 2022 opener last season got 1.353 million viewers in the United States. This year, 1.318. Very, very minor drop. But also, NASCAR dropped. NASCAR had a fairly significant drop, almost 600,000 less viewers this season. And IndyCar also dropped about 300,000 viewers in their opener from last year. F1 had about not even like 35,000 drop. What does that mean? What do you think it means, V?
I think it means that F1 races are really early. This wasn't that early. This was, 9 a.m. Central? But maybe people were sleeping in. That's my guess. I don't necessarily think it means as much as people want it or hope it to mean. But I don't know. What do you think?
Again, I'm in a camp, it means nothing. It's the first race of the season. I mean, people probably didn't even realize it was back, right? What we have to remember is that when you meaning F1, are going after, you know, newer fans, which is what you've pulled in, they are going to be less tied to every single race, every single week. There's more races this season. There's 23. This is a race in March. This is so early in the season, a season that's going to have three races here in the United States now. You know, that's something else they have to think about. Now, I don't know what the numbers look like in other countries. That would be interesting to note. I quite frankly believe that we may see a similar drop in numbers this week in Saudi Arabia. And without sounding like I'm trying to make the Middle East sound bad, but maybe people just don't want to watch a race in the Middle East from the United States. Maybe that's the case. I don't know. I would be very interesting to see what surveys and polls that F1 puts out and what they say, you know, what those, if people report back. I know that they always put surveys out. They just put a survey out for the Bahrain Grand Prix. you know, directly from F1. And if people fill them out, I'm sure they get information that they'll probably never tell us, right? Specifically, like, well, nobody wants a race in Saudi Arabia. Nobody wants to race in Bahrain. But we just had a World Cup in Qatar. And now we have, you know, these back-to-back races in Saudi Arabia or in the Middle East. Are people going to care? I don't know. But it would be, I'll lean more on this theory if it happens again this week. If we don't see a drop, then throw it all out the window. It was just an earlier race in the season. If we see another drop, then I'll be curious to look at Australia in April. But yeah, there's just so much to consider. You know, we had 1 week of racing of testing, also in Bahrain. So essentially, you're having 3 weeks of the Middle East, and that's it. I mean, I think it's a non-factor. I think none of this matters. It was a minor drop. But I do think that having more races is going to cause these types of ebbs and flows in the calendar for random reasons, to no reasons. Maybe people were on spring break with their kids in the United States here. Maybe it was like, I don't know. I'm going based on all of the out of office replies I got last week or a couple weeks ago during that week. I mean, I got so many out of office replies in emails that I was sending out to clients and whatnot. You know, half the people were on spring break or vacations or things like that. So maybe that's a factor. Maybe people were just traveling more that week. There was also tons of weather related things that have been happening in the US, right? From the West Coast to the East Coast to the middle, to the Midwest. I mean, there's been constant like tornado watches and massive snowing and flooding in California. Storms in you know, the upper Midwest and New England, upper New England. Like, there's all this crazy stuff that's been happening. I don't know. Maybe people are just like, I don't care to watch the first race of the season. Like, I don't know. That's all. That's what I believe.
Yeah. I mean, look, Stefano Domenicali said, I'm pretty convinced we are just scratching the surface on this market. We are just looking into the future. And I think what we have to remind ourselves of is that, yes, we are a society that loves our TV. We love our programming. We love all that. But we're also a society that has just come out of a pandemic. And I think a lot of people are going to be less inclined, myself included. I mean, I find myself constantly just leaving my phone at home, like intentionally, or leaving it in the car intentionally. I do not care. I don't want to be bothered. I don't really open my laptop unless it's for work or anything that's really important. And so much of that is just because for about 2 years, really, we were living in this constant doom cycle. We were living in this constant, like, I have to be connected. I have to be able to see everything. I have to know everything. And that was a great time, I think, for people kind of getting into the sport of Formula One. They were downloading as much information as they could during that time, which was great. But at the same time, I think a lot of people are starting to get back to their social norms. And then you look at what's happening right now with the global markets responding to that bank failure. You have to realize that a lot of people right now are probably thinking about a lot of other things that are directly affecting them and their future. So I think as F1 content creators, we want to look at everything and with this really critical lens where, oh, F1 viewership is declining. So, oh, that must mean there's blood in the water. That must mean that fans are leaving the sport. It's not that interesting. They're tired of Max winning. They're tired of this. They're tired of that. They hate the cost cap, et cetera, et cetera. But that might be true for a lot of people. Like, a lot of people were not watching Formula One when Lewis Hamilton was on his winning streak. They were tired of seeing Lewis win. That could very well be the case right now, which is why I think what Aston Martin is doing is so interesting, because I think they're really going to be testing Red Bull, testing Ferrari as the season goes on, as they already have. But I think people have to remind themselves that just because you don't watch a race doesn't mean you're not going to watch it later. doesn't mean you're not going to catch clips later. Doesn't mean you're any less invested in the sport. It's like, I love football. Doesn't mean I sit there and watch every single game on Thursdays, Sundays, and Monday. Absolutely not. Absolutely no way. I used to do that when I was a football writer. And that, I think, is the reason why I don't like watching TV, because I had to for work. And I felt like it was just this, I just didn't feel productive as a person watching that much TV. So there's a lot of different reasons why, you know, how we can interpret this. I don't think this is cause for concern. F1 is growing, whether people like it or not. It's expanding, whether people like it or not. And, you know, I don't think people can do much to stop that. But I don't know. I think that there's a lot of people that maybe are cheering this on in some weird way because they want to be right. But I don't think that does anything for the sport.
No. And this is right now. And F1 is surely looking at the numbers across the board, you know, how they scheduled the calendar. If we look at, first of all, we're talking about United States numbers. I just want to make that clear. The Miami Grand Prix isn't until May 7th. And it's also the, I don't know, fifth race of the season. So you've got four races, two in the Middle East, one that's going to be at 1 a.m. Eastern in Australia. And then you have the Azerbaijan Grand Prix that's early, 7 a.m. Eastern, which means it's going to be 4 a.m. on the West Coast. Okay. So the Miami Grand Prix is the first, like, normal, and I use that very just broadly, normal race, right? It's at 3:30 p.m. on a Sunday in May, right? When it starts to feel maybe a little bit different for some people. And it really kicks off the European season, right? Because then you have Emilia-Romagna, you have Monaco, you have Spanish Grand Prix. Then we go to Canada real quick, which is kind of weird, but Austrian, British, Hungarian, Belgian, Dutch, Italian, like, you have the European season really starting, which this sport is a very Euro-centric, Euro-dominated sport in the mind of Americans, right? So they may think like, I'll watch it when it gets to Europe. Like, that's when it's exciting for me. Right. I mean, listen, Baku is a street track. I think it produces some pretty good racing, but most people don't even know where Azerbaijan is or that it's a country, period. Australia smacked in the middle there. That's going to bring some excitement, but you got it at a weird time. You know, it's at that 1 a.m. time. It's weird time for United States. Let me put it that way. So you've got so many factors, I think, that go into it that, you know, we have to kind of look at the season as a whole. Also, and I mentioned this before, there's three U.S. races now. If you are a newer fan, American F1 fan, you're looking at the season going, oh my God, I'm going to have three opportunities to watch a sport in my time zone or in my country. That's what excites me, right? That's all I care about. I only care about Miami, Austin and Vegas. I don't care about anything else. And maybe the finale if it's a close season. If you're not a diehard, that's all you care about, right? If you're a diehard, yeah, you know that Brazil's a great track and you know that Monza's history and Silverstone, like, you care about that, but maybe you don't care about anything else. So the more races you put here in the United States, I think it's only going to hurt the numbers in the other races here. Or you're going to see more of a true number of those that really care to watch it. So anyway, that's, you know, we can continue to belabor this point. I think there's so many factors. We won't know. This is definitely something I want to pay more attention to though, throughout the season, and see what, you know, what the numbers look like. I'm always tracking these numbers. I'm always looking at them to see, you know, any anomalies. Are the Grand Prix in the United States, are they really making a huge impact? Are the numbers really like blowing them out of the water? Also, we have to remember that this is a very tiny fraction of the total viewership across the world. Viewership around the world is 70 million plus for a Grand Prix. So this is a very minor percentage of the total viewership. And until the numbers get bigger here in the U.S., it's still not going to be taken as seriously. And that's on that note, that's where I'll leave that. Final thoughts, finishing thoughts, parting thoughts. V, what do you have to say? And on anything, the whole show that we covered or anything we didn't cover?
I think it's wild that Lewis Hamilton said he pulled out of shooting Top Gun because of conflicting schedules with F1.
I think it's awesome that he said, and I think it was in Drive to Survive where he, I think it was Drive to Survive where he said something like, I'm not missing, if they shoot another one, I'm not missing it this time.
Yes. He said he won't.
Which is awesome.
So I'm like, could you imagine? Okay. But hypothetically, what if he is on the cusp, maybe a couple races back from potentially winning his eighth title? You think he'd pull out and go film? No. Exactly. No,
I think Lewis is, he wants eight, and it may not seem like it, but I think he's just frustrated with the cars that he's getting, but he wants eight. I believe he's a fighter. I believe that he's a true champion. He wants eight. He wants to walk away saying, don't tie me with my, I'm not tied with Michael. I'm not less than any other driver in this sport. I am the greatest, or at least one of the greatest of all time. And he wants eight. Eight will give him that. I mean, he's already got the number of races, but he wants that championship number.
Yeah.
And I think if you put him in the right car, I don't think his talent has just suddenly gone away. People are like, ah, he's old, this and that. Yes, he might be old by sporting standards, but Fernando Alonso is performing just fine. Tom Brady performed just fine into his mid-40s. I'm pretty sure, Jimmy Johnson is still racing. Jensen Button still races. Like, he'll be okay. He keeps good care of himself. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just go look at his thirst traps that he posts. The dude is in fine shape.
Yeah.
He'll be fine.
Yeah. Speaking of fine shape, last parting thought, though. I think it's okay. Maybe just because I'm a woman, I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. But whenever I go on TikTok, all the videos that I'm seeing on F1 TikTok are about women saying, I should be allowed to comment and say that a driver is hot without people berating me and thinking less of me as a content creator and my ability to actually assess information and content. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that? Like, as a man, what do you think about that?
I think that we are in a culture that's clearly dominated by men. The sport itself is dominated by men. And you have, first of all, let me put this out there. First of all, the internet allows you a modicum of, opaqueness as to who you are, as to your identity, an opaque identity, right? Yeah, you might have a name and a face, but no one knows you, so what does it matter? Or you can be completely random. So you can say things just to say things. And oftentimes, those people that make those comments are just trying to get a rise out of the creator because they're just jealous. I recently sent something to a very good friend of mine who's a creator, female content creator, and she has a very unique set of content. I admire her tremendously for the content that she posts. It's hysterical. It is not my cup of tea overall, but I support it because it's her. And I think I also respect the amount of time and effort she puts into it, which people don't see. And she could just be another commentator on what's happening on the grid. But what do we need another person telling me that Max finished first and a mile ahead of Sergio Perez and Charles' car blew out? Like, I don't need somebody else telling me that. There's plenty of those people. The fact that she puts the time and effort to put out the content she does, I admire tremendously, because to stay consistent through people constantly shitting on her content and to keep growing the way she has, I am I'm proud of her. I'm so happy that she does that. And I think that any creator should be able to talk about whatever they want to in the sport. These dudes are good looking guys. Most of them are very attractive in the upper levels of attractiveness on the scale, right? Like if you were to compare most sports people, these are some of the best looking people on the planet, and they're all competing in a single sport. Like, that's crazy. The concentration is ridiculous. And so why, you know, who cares if that's what someone wants to comment on? What does it matter? Also, it, you or me enjoying a sport because of what the people look like, if that was true, if I solely liked the sport because of how the people looked, how does that affect the way you, or, you know, someone else, you, the commenter, how does that affect the way you enjoy your sport? It doesn't. I'm not telling you how to enjoy the sport. I'm just creating a community for other people that also like looking at these guys or enjoy the content that they post. It really doesn't change the way anybody else views it. It's not like she or he are posting content saying, if you don't like the way these drivers look, you're not an F1 fan. But it's okay for them to say, well, if you don't know the aerodynamic velocities, blah, 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 you're not an F1 fan. It makes no sense, right? It's like you're literally creating the point against yourself. And yeah. So I think that, you know, creators do face an uphill climb. Female creators face an uphill climb with everything they post. If they don't know wheel, if they don't know how to sim race, if they don't know who won every single championship going back to 1950, they're not a real fan. And it's like, well, no one does that to me personally. Like, I don't get questioned, and I don't know a lot of things about Formula One. I'm a fan. I've been a fan, but I don't know every single aspect of the technical. I don't know every... I don't have a good memory when it comes to remembering things that happened in races. So when people are like, oh, remember that? Oh, that was the race in Australia where XYZ happened. I don't remember those things. I just don't. It's not something that I've never been good at. Even with other sports, I'm just not very good at that. Probably because I occupy my mind and time with a lot of things. So it's like, what's more important to me to keep in my head, especially when we have things like Google where I can look it up. But I've never been questioned as a man. No one. I can't remember a time that I've had comments that question my, you know, my fandom or my level of knowledge. And quite frankly, I probably said very stupid things that, you know, are even dumber than people that don't know the sport at all. And no one's ever questioned me. And so I think that, you know, the content creators, the female content creators out there that are constantly putting out content and fighting through it, they are the person in the arena, to quote Teddy Roosevelt, human in the arena. And, you know, it's not the critic that counts. That's something that is in there. It's not the critic that matters. It's not the person who's sitting there laughing at you or watching you, because they're not the one that's doing it every day. They're not the one that's cranking out content for others' enjoyment and entertainment. That's not an easy thing to do every single day, to have content to create, especially when you're getting shit on. And so all of those that are doing it, if you're listening to this show and, you know, if you are creating content or want to start creating content or are interested, just push through it and don't listen to the people that are, you know, naysaying. The reason they're doing it is because they're not the ones creating the content. They're not the ones getting the engagement. They're not the ones that are getting the opportunities to go to livery launches and to races and to cover these things. They're not getting those opportunities. So they're just jealous, right? You're the one who is putting in the sweat, the blood, the tears, very real tears for people that are getting harassed, females, men and women, anybody, that creator that's getting harassed. There's real tears being shed by people that are just assholes online. And if you listen to this and you are one of those assholes that makes comments, like, just stop. It's not worth it. It's a waste of your time, and you're hurting real people.
Yeah. Well, also too, there's the very real possibility that people are going to find out who you are making these berating comments, and find out who you are and find out everything about your life and where you live and where you work. And that's not a good position you want to put yourself into just because you want to make some nasty remark on social media. It's not worth it.
You know, and I'm just going to, this is my last point on that. It, even if that should not be the impetus, you should just not post things like that because you don't want to hurt another human being. Like, there's no need to hurt someone, or there's no need to tear somebody else down to make yourself feel bigger. There's a sign that's hanging in my office that my team made for me back in 2017. It's something that I say a lot, that I believe in, and it's build the biggest building. And what that means is just focus on building the biggest building you can. You don't need to tear somebody else's building down to make yours look bigger or feel bigger, right? Just focus on your own. Build the biggest one you can, and that's all that matters. You don't need to go rip somebody else apart so that you can feel like a champion, because that's not going to make you feel like a champion at the end of the day.
Yeah. Amen. Amen. Very well said. And I hope that yeah, those female content creators get a hold of this and listen to this and know that they are all female creators, all creators really are supported and appreciated. And doesn't matter if you talk about whether a driver is sexy or whether you talk about aerodynamics, you're all valued, and we appreciate every single minute that you guys put into content creation.
Appreciate you all. Thank you for listening to yet another episode of the VF1 Show. I'm Vincenzo. On the other side of the line is
VF
Vanessa Francesca. But you said that last week. So there's a little thing from last week. Thanks for listening. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review our show on your favorite podcast player. It helps us get discovered, and it just makes us feel good. If you want a question of yours answered on the show, go leave a rating and review. In the review, ask the question. We will put it on the show, guaranteed. Again, of course, if it's appropriate. For another episode of the VF1 Show, I'm Vincenzo. We will see you later.
Thank you so much for tuning into the VF1 Show. If you liked it, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And for previews of next week's show, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at the VF Castro and Vincenzo Landino.